Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. Welcome to the maiden voyage of our brand new podcast. It's a deep dive conversation with innovators from around the world. To get us started, I'm speaking with Tanya Selvaratnam, author of The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. Welcome to our brand shiny new podcast, Tanya. So why did you write this book?
I got the idea for the book after my third miscarriage, which was in fall 2011. And at that time, I was 40 years old. I had first gotten pregnant when I was 37, and after that first miscarriage, my OBGYN told me to console me, "You have time." But then after that third miscarriage, when I was 40, my OBGYN said, "The biggest factor is going to be your age." So I was struck by their definition of time. How much time is enough time? And when does it become too late? And as I talked to my friends and started doing research, I realized that I certainly wasn't alone in feeling like I had not educated myself about my own fertility adequately, and also that society had not given me the correct information. And I feel like so many women and men are making decisions based on incomplete, inaccurate, or missing information, and the solutions are tangible because there are people suffering, and the constituency of people suffering is growing. There are approximately 12% of people worldwide who are dealing with infertility, and I feel like something's got to give because there's a lot of money being made on infertility too. I mean, the global IVF industry is at about $9 billion right now. By 2020, it's expected to rise to above $21 billion. So somebody's making a lot of money off of other people's suffering and struggle. So that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, just to increase the information and also to provide people with a message of hope. Because we spend so much time pitching ourselves against the expectations and judgments of others. And the most important thing is really to define what happiness means for you, whether it involves kids or not.
You have been touring extensively for this book, and you've been on many media outlets, including CNN with Dr. Sanjay Gupta. What have you found in terms of talking to individuals about your life experiences, which are woven through this statistics-heavy, research-heavy book? What kinds of things do people tell you after you get off the podium or the microphone? What kind of conversations are you having?
I've been surprised by how many people who have interviewed me have their own story to tell. Almost every single one, whether it was dealing with a miscarriage, and this is men and women. There was one radio show host who interviewed me who told me about the experience that he had with his and his wife's miscarriage, and they found out that he was the reason. And that's what inspired me to write the book anyway, is knowing that almost everybody I spoke to had a story to tell about their own dealings with infertility, miscarriage, abortion, etc.
And Tanya, you spoke with Dr. Sanjay Gupta of CNN, and let's just listen to a little bit of your conversation.
We're surrounded by this culture where you see women having babies much older. It's on the cover of magazines, and it's something that, you know, we tout as an accomplishment. You think that's part of the lie as well, that people are more willing to accept the fact that it's not a problem to delay? We see it everywhere.
Well, I think, especially in today's society, which is so based on images, we prefer the positive spin. We prefer to present the positive image. And one of the goals with the book is that people share their stories so that we can balance the optimistic scenarios with the heartbreaking ones. I mean, the point of the book is not that people won't be successful in having a pregnancy when they're in their late 30s and 40s. It's just that you need to be aware of the statistics so that you're more prepared, so that you're armed with information to make better choices. And part of it is the celebrity culture that shows us all of the success stories of women having kids in their late 30s and late 40s.
So, Tanya, after that conversation, what did you learn from Dr. Gupta about just how people, you know, even journalists process this idea?
Well, it was fascinating. First of all, being on Dr. Sanjay Gupta's show was a dream come true. But what was fascinating is when we were having our conversation off air, he said he was surprised by how much debate my book caused in their like newsroom when they were talking about possible segments and planning for the future ones. He said that there were, you know, women and men had very strong opinions, like, yes, everybody knows this stuff. No, we don't. It's a problem. He was really amazed.
Would you consider yourself a career woman, whatever that means to you?
Definitely.
We're going to get into your career later in this interview, your extensive career in the arts. But do you think that that self-definition as a career woman meant that you thought children were something that could come later, just kind of by necessity? It was like, oh, I'm a career woman. I can just wait.
It wasn't so much that I was a career woman and so I could wait. It was a combination of factors. It was a combination of being, of knowing what I wanted and who I wanted to be with. You know, I was definitely somebody who hoped that I would find the right partner one day to have a child with. And then when I did, I was 35 years old. And we got married when I was 37, and I got pregnant very soon thereafter. We all know that vaguely after 35, your fertility goes down, that it becomes harder, but we don't know how steeply. And I find it very misleading that people present it as very possible, especially with reproductive science and fertility treatments, because the truth is those statistics really do go down radically from year to year. So I feel like one of the things I want to do with the book is present the actual statistics. And I wove in my personal story to help pull the reader in so that they have something to connect to, so that they can identify with it and also feel that they weren't alone.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me you give a really extensive outline of some of the development of reproductive technology and, including in 1978, the first IVF baby, or what was then called test tube baby, was born in the UK. And in those intervening decades, which haven't been that long, you've also charted the rise of this industry. You mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of people are making money off of this. Do you think that the fertility industry itself has some complicity in, you know, how women are thinking about boundless possibility when hormones and ovaries may be saying otherwise?
It's hard to stereotype a whole industry as saying that they are complicit. I think that there are those who are seeing it as a business venture and are willing to mislead women into thinking that anything is possible with fertility treatments. And then there are those who are more responsible. I know with my doctor, my fertility doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital, she was very blunt with me. And she told me exactly what the statistics were, for, you know, from 38, 39, 40, 41, 42. And with regard to egg freezing, you know, when I was 40 years old and I asked her about egg freezing, she's like, I could take your money and do it, but here are the statistics.
Yeah.
You know, but there aren't a lot of doctors who are willing to do that. I mean, I know people who at 42, 43 are freezing their eggs. When we really should be talking about the multiple ways in which people can build families, we really should be talking more proactively about adoption and egg donors, et cetera. And we also have to be advocating for changes in policy so that it just doesn't feel like elite rich people can pursue these treatments. Because we have to realize that we've created a society in which it's hard enough to support yourself to get by. Where you live in a society that's riddled with debt. When you add building a family into that, most people see it as unfeasible. It costs about $235,000 to raise a child for the first 17 years, and that's without fertility treatments. And there are only 15 states in the country that mandate some form of fertility treatment coverage. So where you live and how much you make really determines whether you can pursue parenthood.
The subtitle of your book is Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock, but you aren't against feminism. So can you read us a little bit from the book and explain?
Definitely. You might not want to call yourself a feminist. You might not identify with famous feminists, but can't you get behind what feminism advocates? Feminism encourages a broader democratic framework that counters the fundamentalist backlash, which is a never-ending threat to women around the world every day. When I was growing up, there was a tension between feminism, which told women to do what they wanted, and the medical establishment, which told women not to delay motherhood. What we can do moving forward is recast feminism to incorporate more fully the reality of our fertilities.
So let me turn more explicitly to your own story. You mention having gotten married in your late 30s and getting pregnant almost immediately. What were the circumstances under which you began to understand how fragile that moment was. You know, I almost hate to take you there because, first off, we do know each other personally and have since college. But you go into some very, what must be painful details of what happened to that first pregnancy and your subsequent one. So walk us through what it meant for you to experience three pregnancies that did not come to term.
Well, looking back on that time in my life, it does feel abstract to me that when I was going through it, and writing the book helped me heal a lot, and also connecting with other people around my story has been very healing. And it was very important for me to share as much as I could of my personal story. And it was a real question for me how deeply I go, because in a nutshell, what happens in the book, for those who haven't read it yet, is I start getting pregnant when I'm 37. I have three miscarriages by the time I'm 40. I decide to pursue fertility treatment. And then after being greenlit by insurance to be covered, I'm declared in perfect health. All the machinery is working right. I get thousands of dollars worth of fertility drugs, most of which thankfully were covered by insurance, but not all. And then the next day I go for a baseline ultrasound. And during that ultrasound, they discover a growth. I'll cut to the end, which is that IVF process was halted. I went through many tests, an MRI, biopsy, CAT scan, and was diagnosed with two different types of cancer. So there were two different tumors. And I had to have surgery, and the process of pursuing parenthood was very much put on hold while I healed. And then as I was healing, my marriage fell apart. So I'm very much in a place right now where I'm rebuilding, going through major transitions, but it's also a time of great fulfillment because of what I've been able to do around the book.
But going back to your story, speaking about understanding bodies, what changed in terms of how you understood your own body between getting pregnant and having these miscarriages and then being diagnosed with cancer and then successfully triumphing over cancer? Let's break that down into stages.
Yeah.
What did you learn about yourself when you got pregnant? Your body, yourself?
I learned that we are a bunch of parts, and that even when you look good on the outside, that the body is mysterious and you just never know what's going to happen. And the most important thing is to surround yourself with good people and good work and have great doctors. I love my doctors. They were amazing. And even though my story might seem sad to some, for those who get to the end, you realize like how what happened to me was in some ways a gift, because it helped me kind of reprioritize and open up to the world in a way that I might not have before. Like there was a silver lining that my struggles resulted in my being able to save my own life. Because if it had been, you know, a couple more years that the tumors could grow, it might have been too late. And these are the great unknowns. I also learned when I was pregnant and miscarrying the unfathomable impact of hormones that we don't really understand. I mean, just that one basic fact, the impact of hormones on our physiologies and psychologies. And this is also something that I think should be part of sex education. I think people aren't educated about this stuff enough, the changes that you go through.
You're listening to One with Farai, part of Soundworks from PRI. We're speaking with Tanya Selvaratnam, author of The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. So I wanted to ask you about a section you have on advances in reproductive technology, and you call it the Wild West of reproductive science. What are we talking about that's pushing the envelope these days?
In reproductive science, experiments that happen in the lab go too quickly to becoming practice. And it has only been around for a couple of decades, IVF. And egg freezing was experimental until fall 2012. These are relatively new technologies, and we don't know what the long-term issues are going to be of children born from IVF, from the people who've gone through fertility treatments, etc. I just think there needs to be more responsibility and caution in using them too indiscriminately. I think people need to be responsible. And again, it goes back to education and awareness. I think that the doctors have to be more informative with their patients, really walking them through the process. And some are and some aren't. I mean, I have friends who feel like they were totally blindsided by the impact. I was lucky. I had a great one. And there just needs to be more research in general on men in particular. There's been a lot of gender bias in the research. Now more is starting to come out that men have a biological clock too. The connection between the advanced paternal age and some developmental disorders, autism, schizophrenia, etc. More research like that needs to happen. And more research on the psychological impact of infertility. It's starting. There was a study that came out a couple of months ago, actually around the same time that my book came out. They studied, I think, 54,000 couples. And of those couples that pursued fertility treatments, those that were unsuccessful after a dozen years were three times as likely to divorce. And I did a recent reading, you know, actually at every reading I've done, there has been at least one woman who has had a breakup with her boyfriend or husband because they wanted to have children, they thought together, and it wasn't working out, and the relationship fell apart. There was a woman at my reading just this last week who came up to me afterwards and said, I wish I had your book 10 years ago. And I talk about the impact on relationships. And that was an area of research I did not expect to go into, but I was inspired to because of what happened in my own personal story. I mean, that's the good thing about my personal story and it being so crazy. So many different things happened along the spectrum of what can happen when you start to pursue fertility treatments that I was able to explore a lot of areas like underlying health conditions uncovered by fertility treatments, breakup of marriages because of, you know, influenced by fertility treatments, etc.
And you write in the book talking about the breakup of your marriage. That was it. He was gone. The love of my life, the father of our future children. Where do I go now? And where you went was into this book. And you mentioned that it's been a healing journey.
Mm-hmm.
What took you from theoretically thinking, maybe I have a story to tell, to saying, I'm going to write a book, which is very different. Having written books myself, actually completing one is kind of a pain in the butt. What got you through that process?
I started writing the book when I was at a very different place in my life. When I was, as I said before, having a third miscarriage and noticing that there was a lack of comprehensive and cohesive information in one place for people. And I thought, you know, because I'm an activist, because I've worked a lot with women's groups and youth groups, I said, I feel like there's a lack here that I can fill. So that's why I started writing the book. And then as far as it becoming a healing process for me and taking me to a different place, I got an offer on my book the week after my husband said he was leaving me. And I said, the universe has a different plan for me. And it allowed me to focus on something outside of myself. I was like, I have an obligation. I have a purpose. I'm going to keep doing the research. I hid myself away, surrounded myself only with very close friends. And I was able to focus in a way that I had never focused before.
If you could go and talk to 16-year-old Tanya Selvaratnam about fertility, what would you tell her?
I would tell her the reality of her fertility span. I would give her the numbers, whether or not she remembers them all. At least I will feel like I have told her what the statistics are at different age groups of being able to carry to get pregnant, to carry a child to term, have a successful fertility treatment. I would also tell her to think about her future proactively. We wing it so much, and there's a beauty in winging it, but there are some aspects like becoming a parent that maybe we should strategize about more. So I would ask her to think about whether or not she wants to have kids. If she doesn't now, to consider that she might want to have them in the future and how to prepare herself if her mind does change. I would ask her to think really carefully about partners because I know I went out with a lot of bad boys when I was in high school and college, and I wish that I'd paid more attention to the good guys. So those are a couple of things. And I would tell her to have, you know, to talk about these issues with her peers. Don't feel ashamed about them.
Well, I want to turn to the professional life that you have built over the course of a couple of decades, which certainly may not be the only thing that took you to this path, as you pointed out. But while you were, you know, not having children, younger in life, you have done a remarkable array of different kinds of work in the activism and feminism and cultural sphere. Just give us a little taste of some of the the ways that you got into those different aspects of your life. Like, how did you get into being a theatrical producer? How did you get into being a documentary producer? How did you decide you could just do all this stuff that some people dream their whole lives of doing and never have been able to do?
My first producing gig was for the Women's Conference in China. I was part of the organizing committee of the NGO Forum on Women, and I was studying Chinese and the history of law at Harvard, and they needed a assistant youth coordinator, specifically somebody to produce the arts and culture events. And I jumped at the chance. And also I spoke Chinese, and I think I was the only one who spoke Chinese on the organizing committee. So that gave me real joy. And then with the documentary producing, that came out of left field. I first started with narrative films. It was a friend from college whom I had done theater with, and he had gone out to Hollywood and was working in the studio system, wanted to make his own film independently, remembered me from college and called me up and was like, would you work on this with me? His name is Jed Weintraub, and that film got into Sundance and it got into the Berlin Film Festival. So when you have, you know, your first film out of the gate and it does that, people think you can produce. And I feel like I'm still learning at producing. I mean, now it's been 16 years and I have some great projects that I'm working on right now. I just finished a documentary by Micheline Thomas called Happy Birthday to a Beautiful Woman. That's a documentary about her mother and muse. And that was on HBO in February.
Yes, amazing visual artist for those who don't know her work.
Yep. And I have a film by documentary filmmaker Catherine Gund about Daredevil choreographer Elizabeth Streb. And that's called Born to Fly. It premiered at South by Southwest and it'll be at Film Forum in New York in September. I just finished helping produce a series of events at the Guggenheim Museum, orchestrated by Carrie Mae Weems, the MacArthur Award-winning visual artist who had a retrospective at the Guggenheim. So I'm lucky to work with a lot of women who really inspire me and keep me in this game. Because the truth is, my real love is writing. Always has been from the time I was a kid. I never had the confidence to say I'm a writer. And I feel lucky with this book that I've been able to make that leap, but I hope to segue into more writing, more journalistic writing, and I have a novel that I want to write as I move forward. I'll still stay involved with great projects. I've been talking to Laura Dawn, who was the creative director of Move On, and we're starting to work on a documentary, actually, ironically, about men, that I'm very excited about. And working on some theater projects as well, because I do love acting. And acting and writing are a good balance, because the writing is very solitary, and I can go for days without seeing people. And the acting is so social. You're in a room with a bunch of kooky people making stuff, making it happen, and then dealing with an audience.
Again, we're speaking to Tanya Selvaratnam, author of The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. She is also a documentary and theatrical and event producer extraordinaire. And one of the things you produced is Made Here, a series of mini documentaries about the working lives of artists and the, you know, imaginations. And you've covered the aspects of what it's like to live in New York and what it's like to be a creator on a very granular level. So let's take a listen to Khalil al-Mustafa.
When I wrote 100 poems in 100 days, I did the 100 donors, $100 campaign to try to get 100 people to give me $100. And I called a lot of people. You know how people say, call your friends and family first? I did that. And it was rough. It really got me in touch with how little people value what I do, have no idea what I do. Think that I need to get a job still. I perform in people's living rooms where I read poetry. I get them to write poetry, and then we sell books at the end, and I make a little money.
So listening to Khalil al-Mustafa, have you ever been told, Tanya, just get a job? Come on, you speak Chinese, you went to Harvard. Why don't you work for an investment bank?
Every time I talk to my mom.
And what's your reply?
I'm happy. And there are things that I do to support the things I want to do. We have one life on this earth, and it's very important for me that I tie my passion to my labor. Because otherwise, I think you just end up soulless. And I have great respect for people who can do a 9-to-5 job and just focus on paying the bills. But I also think it's important to be passionate about what you do.
Yeah, I was talking to someone who, you know, who works at a job. He said, it doesn't bother me. Those were his exact words. And I thought that was fascinating. He was like, you know, it's not particularly interesting and may or may not have any social value, but it doesn't bother me. And there, you know, that's better than certainly than having a job that's harmful in some ways, which some people also are like, well, I'll do whatever I have to get paid the way I want to.
You're working on a book about this, but there is a work crisis on this planet with how we value people's work. And that was one of the great things about Made Here, the documentary series that I produced, which Chiara Clemente directed, and Here Art Center is the executive producer, is we heard the stories from artists themselves about how to make their lives function. You know, that you can do it. You can achieve your dreams and get by, even in a place that's as ridiculously expensive as New York City.
Well, to that point, you put together a montage that closed out season four of Made Here with people talking about just what it takes to make it. So let's take a listen to that.
Don't be afraid to fail. Like, fail. There's nothing better than authentic failure on stage. There really isn't.
Get a thick skin. I think this city can like raise you up and beat you down in like the same moment, you know? So I think that be strong.
You better love it. And you better be a badass. Don't explain and don't complain. Now have fun.
Those are hard instructions. Like, don't explain and don't complain. Now have fun. It's like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to have fun too? You know, that's a rough order.
It's rough. I mean, the thing that I would add to that is I think it's important to identify what you're passionate about and then figure out who can help you achieve that. You have to ask for what you need. And there are too many people who struggle because they don't ask for what they need. And, you know, women often have a problem with that in the workplace, et cetera. I mean, which is one of the things I talk about in the book. It's like you need to ask because don't expect people to give it to you. You need to ask to be paid. You know, it's fascinating to me.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of research, which I've been doing for the book that I'm working on about the future of work, about how women have to have different strategies. One example is that a study found that generally for men, having a competing offer is seen as the best way to get a higher salary. For women, it's not always the case. Sometimes women are seen as ungrateful for actually getting another offer rather than being self-sufficient. So yeah. There's so many gender rules. I think in a parallel way to what we were talking about with fertility, there are gendered rules about work.
And we need to call the perpetrators out. I mean, I've heard stories recently of two people who lost their jobs, one of which was at like a smaller production company, because they got pregnant and their partner or employer freaked out. To seek recourse can be really frustrating and exhausting and costly. So then what do you do? A lot of people I know just move on.
Yeah.
But then these infractions keep happening.
So much to talk about. But, you know, before we go, and we do have to go, I wanted to turn to something else in your book, which is that I recently did an event for a great group called Girls Right Now with a W.
Oh, yeah,
WRITE Now. And I talked about the ways in which writing is soul work, meaning it gets to your core, and that there are some things you can do in writing that you just, it's harder to do in face-to-face conversation. Mm-hmm. And you talk in your book about being at Phillips Academy at Andover and learning bulimia, which is throwing up food from some other girls. And you've read my story about being bulimic, and we've talked about it, but it wasn't until I read your book that I realized that you had also gone through this.
Really?
We had just never talked about it. It's probably something that wasn't, it sounds like you had a less long duration, but we just never.
Well, it was many years.
Yeah, but we just never talked about it.
And it start, when did yours start?
In college.
Yeah, I was young.
Yeah.
So it feels distant to me. I was 13.
Yeah, but it just fascinated me. I was like, oh, I've known her for 20-odd years, and we've had the conversation about bulimia, which could be another whole show about eating disorders.
And self-worth.
Self-worth.
And education.
Yeah, exactly.
Did anybody talk to me when I was in elementary school and said, these are eating disorders, these are some strategies for how to avoid them, this is what you should do if you get them? So many girls.
And also, at least in my experience, young women of color are not seen as potential sufferers. It's like this, it's one of these things where it's like it's assumed to be that everyone who is experiencing this eating disorder is going to be upper middle class
white wanting to be skinny.
Right.
Right. They don't realize that sometimes it's
I think it's a stress management technique.
Stress management, exactly. And stress management, insecurity, and psychological reasons.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we both dealt with problems at the home.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you ingest that anxiety?
Yeah.
And then purge it?
When I was 8, as you well know, my father left and I didn't see him again until I was 27. And so much of my personal journey as a woman has been about processing a delayed sense of grief about that relationship. And although your parents stayed together, they had their moments
as well.
They had
a bad marriage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I could keep going and I feel like we're just getting steam, but I want to leave people hanging, wanting to read The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock, your new book. But I also want you to kick off a chain, kick off the first in a long chain of paying it forward, meaning that we're going to do, and you as an arts person, who better, do a version of Exquisite Corpse, which is a art game or a word game where one person either draws part of something or gives a sentence and then the next person and the next person. So we're going to have our guest toss something to a future guest and you won't know who that guest is. So what would you like to ask another fascinating world changer who you haven't met? Anything.
There was that show in the 70s called In Search Of that I was addicted to. And I'm working on a piece called In Search Of ... bookstores. And I think writing this book has invigorated my love of bookstores. And my question would be, when was the last time you were in a physical bookstore and what book did you buy?
And on the next episode of One with Farai, we'll find out how our next guest answers Tanya's question. Thanks again, Tanya.
Thanks, Farai.
Tanya Selvaratnam is the author of The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of SoundWorks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. On the next show, professor, author, and MSNBC host Melissa Harris Perry, talking about politics, literature, family, and more.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
SoundWorks.
SoundWorks.
From PRI.